Shall we? We are up to the last part of Perek Yudalet, of chapter 14. And what I would like to do is to obviously wrap up chapter 14, which is the story of the Plishtim, the Philistines, and make headway in chapter 15. How much of it we'll make, who knows? But we're going to do something, God willing. So, we are, if you're using the stone Tanakh, we're on page 979. We are at chapter 14, sentence 28. You will recall that we're in the section of prophecies against the 10 enemies, the 10 foes, saying that they will collapse. You should not try to make treaties with them. Don't try to side with them. And the first one was Babylon. That was chapter 13 and the great majority of 14. Babylon will be invaded. It will end up in ruins. The Jews will be redeemed. And then you get this very short passage about the Plishtim, the Philistines. What do we know about the relationship between Jews and Plishtim?
Bad.
Well, you can fill in the pretty much any nation in the region there. Like I could have named pretty much any of them. He got that reaction. Right. But go back further, right? We have a very old history with people who live in the land of Pleshet. Now, keep in mind, I worded that carefully. I say people who live in Pleshet because there's some debate as to when exactly you can truly call them Plishtim. The Plishtim are invaders. They are sea people who originally live up in the Ionian Sea area, up to the northwest, and they have to leave their land, whether that's because of resource issues or because of strife back there. I've read too many different accounts at this point, but they migrate down the coast and they settle in the area that we call Gaza. Right? That's where they end up. They have five central cities: Ekron, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gat, and Gaza. Right? We know them very well in Sefer Shmuel. But we use the term Plishti in the Torah going back to the time of Abraham with Abimelech. And that's what causes a lot of debate among historians because of the question of exactly when this group arrived. It's not really of great consequence in terms of the Torah because the answer can always be we name people based on the area where they live. And it could be that in Abraham's day they weren't called Plishtim, they were called something else. It's possible. But the Torah very often names things based on later events. It wouldn't bother me terribly to find out that was so. Although, I have seen those who make an effort to show that the archaeological evidence can support Plishtim being there in the time of Abraham. Either way, that's where our history starts. It starts with King Abimelech of the city of Gerar and Abraham and Sarah. That was Sarah's second trip to a foreign palace. Then you have Abimelech with Yitzchak, and again, that whole business with Yitzchak saying that Rivka is his sister and not succeeding in fooling Abimelech. And then there's kind of silence with the Plishtim. We don't have that much to do with them until you get to the period of the Shoftim, specifically the latter part of the period of the Shoftim, correct, with Shimshon. Meaning the earlier part of the period of the Shoftim, there really isn't much going on between us and the Plishtim, the Philistines. It's only really at the end. And the Samson story, the Shimshon story, is all about that strife between the Plishtim and the Jews. The Plishtim are clearly a dominant force at that point in our history, and we are suffering from it. Janine? We know that they're there. It's just that they don't really have much to do with us. One thing you have to keep in mind, and this is the sort of thing which you don't pick up in day school because they don't stress it, and they should, is that Israel is really two lands. You can make the argument for three, but certainly at least two lands. You have the land of Canaan, and then you have the land of the Plishtim. Canaan is the area closer to the Jordan. That's where the Canaanite tribes live. And then the Plishtim are off to the west, towards the water. Again, whether you call them Plishtim at that point in history, you call them something else, that's Eretz Plishtim, the land of the Plishtim. Such that if you read the career of Abraham and Sarah carefully, you can discern, and the commentators point this out in the beginning of Parshas Chaye Sarah, you can discern two separate eras for Abraham and Sarah. Their initial period is when they are in Hebron, right? And that's in the land of Canaan. And then, after that, the other period in Beersheba, which is the land of the Plishtim. You're down in the Negev towards where Gerar is, towards that area in the southwest, even though Beersheba technically I don't think is in Plishti territory, so to speak, but that's that area is their trip to the Plishtim. And the best evidence of it, let's point it out, because it's worth seeing this inside in order to really grasp what we're saying, because it's a pasuk that we read every single year, and people don't follow the import of what they are reading. Turn to the end of Parshas Vayera, please, after the Akedah, the binding of Isaac. Page 48 in the Stone Tanakh, it is Breshit, Genesis, the end of chapter 22. It's chapter 22, sentence 19. Okay? Where does Abraham go after the Akedah? Beersheba. Right? That's where Abraham goes. Yitzchak, of course, is not listed as going anywhere, and that's its own discussion. That makes sense that Abraham will go to Beersheba, because when the story opened, if you go back a page, the end of the previous chapter, we're told Abraham lived in the land of the Plishtim for many days. Okay? Check. That all works. The problem is the beginning of Chaye Sarah, which commentators tend to assume starts at the time of the Akedah, without any lapse of time in between. Look at it. It says that Sarah lived 127 years, and Sarah died where? Kiryat Arba, he Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham, Vayavo Abraham, Abraham came to eulogize Sarah. But where was Abraham? He has to show up for this. Why? Because he was in Beersheba. Abraham wasn't there with Sarah when she passed away. Abraham was off in the land of the Plishtim. Sarah was in the land of Canaan. So I didn't invent this. If you look at Ramban, if you look at Kliyakar, you look at Sfarno, all the standard Mikraot Gedolot commentaries look at what was going on here, and they give fascinating answers. It's a remarkable issue, and I'm not going to blow the ending. You can look it up. But I highlight it here in order to show this division between the land of the Plishtim and the land of Canaan. It's a division that goes all the way back to this point. The trick is, and the reason why we don't notice it, is because one is in the end of Parshas Vayera, and the other one's the beginning of Parshas Chaye Sarah, and therefore you go to Shul one week, and you hear this, and by the next week you forgot what you read last week. So you don't stop and think, wait, this is Eretz Canaan, Avram was in the land of Plishtim, what's going on? The trick is to learn Chumash, not to learn Parsha. That's the idea. So, going back now to where we are then, the Plishtim are there, whoever's inhabiting the Plishti land are there all along. As Janine noted, when the Jews get out of Mitzrayim, they don't go through the land of the Plishtim, this land in the south-southwest. The Plishtim emerge as a major foe towards the end of the period of the Shoftim, centuries after we enter the land of Canaan. And then the Plishtim are a problem for us perpetually. So during the period of Shmuel, they fight with us, they take the Aron, they return the Aron, they have a further war with us, then, of course, they kill Shaul HaMelech, they kill King Saul, they have this odd relationship going with King David, right? The Plishtim are a foe of ours throughout that time, and then after David HaMelech, after King David, we have a period when we are the ones who are in control over them. And I gave you some references on the sheet. If you take a look at source number one, I'm not going to go through each of the psukim that I listed here in the interests of time. But first of all, Shlomo HaMelech dominates them. So through David into the time of Shlomo, we're doing pretty well. Then we are told in Divrei HaYamim Bet, Chronicles 2, that Yehoshaphat, a few generations down the line among the kings of Judea, rules over the Plishtim and they send him tribute. Then we find out the part that we do have to pause and read, Chronicles 2, chapter 26. We actually saw this, I believe, in the beginning of the year when we were talking about King Uzziahu. Remember that Uzziahu was the king before Ahaz. Uzziahu was the one we talked about in chapters 2 through 6 of the book. He's the one who has this period of great wealth and they're doing very well. And Yeshayahu was warning against overindulgence. Sorry?
1980.
Page 1980? Okay, thank you. Is it? Really? I have it on 1993.
Didn't you say Divrei HaYamim 20?
Chapter 2, sentence 26. It's on your sheet. If you take a look at number 1, the third line in number 1. Chronicles 2, chapter 26, sentences 6 and 7. Yeah. So, this is describing Uzziahu's success. He went to war against the Philistines. And he broke through the wall of Gat. It's page 1993. He broke through the wall of Gat and the wall of Yavneh and the wall of Ashdod. He built up cities in Ashdod and Plishtim. Vayazirehu ha'elokim al Plishtim va'al ha'arvim. Hayoshvim Begur Baal, etc. Hashem helped him against the Plishtim as well as the Arab tribes who lived in that land. So what we're told is that Uzziahu dominates the Plishtim. That turns in the time of King Ahaz. We already talked about this. Do you remember we talked about the Syro-Ephraimite alliance and we said that the nation of Aram makes an incursion south. They're where Syria is. And they come down the Jordan to try to gain allies by force or by diplomacy as needed against the ultimate Assyrian invasion. So they come down and around to the Plishtim, to the Philistines, and they create an alliance with the Philistines. We read about this in Yeshaya. If you go back to Yeshaya chapter 9, sentence 11... Right? Sentences 10 and 11. What page? Sorry? 968. Thank you. You are told that Aram mikedem uplishtim me'achor v'yochlu et Yisrael b'chol peh b'chol zot lo shav apo v'od yado nituya. This is talking about the destruction of that alliance, of the Syro-Ephraimite alliance. And the prediction is going to be that Yisrael is going to suffer at the hands of their former allies. Aram from the east and the Plishtim from behind them. They're going to be forced to fight on two fronts. And then, in Yeshaya chapter 11, one last verse. Chapter 11, sentence 14. We had a prediction about the future. Ve'afu bekatev plishtim yama. Right? This is talking about a future time, whether it's Chizkiyahu or a time of Mashiach, when Judea will be triumphant and they are going to conquer the plishtim, as well as a whole bunch of other nations. So what you're seeing here is that after David HaMelech, we have a period of control over them. But after Uzziahu dies, the Philistines, the Plishtim, become a threat. That's the problem. And there's more to be said about that, but I want to get to the actual psukim. That's where we're going. That's exactly where we're going. You are correct. So, the role of our prophecy here is a message about these Plishtim. And as Ora just said, it's going to begin by saying this is in the year that Ahaz dies. The Plishtim, through the reign of Ahaz, have been ascendant. So in the year that Ahaz dies, this message comes to the Plishtim. You think that you are going to be free of Jewish control. You think your alliance that you're making with the Northern Kingdom, the alliance you're making with Aram, is going to help you. Your plot is going to fail. And of course, as we've said, the real audience is not the Plishtim. The Plishtim aren't listening to Isaiah. The audience is us, in order to communicate that message to us. And that's what we get here. The fundamental message in this really short passage is, the Jews look weak, but they are dangerous, and let the word go forth of what's going to happen to the Plishtim. So let's take a look now. Chapter 14, sentence 28. It's page 979, if you are using the Stone Tanakh. Yes?
There's so much prophesizing about what happens to all the other people around us, around Israelites. Are we to assume that never once was it heeded, never once did they have a...
Right, so again, I go back to what I said in the beginning of chapter 13. This isn't targeting them. Yeshaya is not walking into any of these capitals to tell them as Yonah does.
I realize that, I'm just wondering, is there any historical...
Not that I know of.
Okay.
But it's also not surprising. Keep in mind what we said regarding the vision against Bavel, that that vision may not even have been promoted at this point. This may have been one of those that he gives his students and says, seal it up, don't tell it, because it wouldn't have made any sense to a nation that didn't know any Babylonians. They hadn't done anything wrong yet in order to get the punishment that's ultimately coming to them. So take a look, please, at the opening in sentence 28. Bishnasmos HaMelech Achaz, in the year of the death of King Achaz, Haya HaMasa Hazeh. That's when this Masa came. Remember, Masa is a burden. It's generally speaking a vision of punishment. Al Tismechi Feleshes Kulech, Kinishbar Shevet Makech. Do not rejoice, Pleshet. Why would they rejoice? Moish, why would they have rejoiced, these Plishtim?
I'm not having too much fun.
Oh, I'm not. Why would the Plishtim rejoice? It's not a source of fun. They would have rejoiced because Achaz is dead. Right? The Jewish king is dead. So the Plishtim want to rejoice. He says, don't start celebrating. You're counting your chickens. Ki nishbar shevet makeich. You think the rod that struck you is broken. You think that, just like in Achaz's day, you were ascendant. You think that's going to continue. I have bad news for you. It's not going to happen. Ki mishoresh nachash yetzei tsefa ufiryo saraf me'ofeith. Because from the root of the serpent is going to come a tsefa. I don't know how your editions translate tsefa. I always translated tsefa as a viper. They have viper. When I was in Israel during the first Gulf War, and they had when they sent out the message over the radio, they had to go into the sealed room because the Scuds were coming. So the announcement was Nachash Tsefa.
The
a basilisk? You don't want to mess with a basilisk. Not according to Harry Potter.
Well, that's according to
the
translation.
So the basilisk, if you look at the basilisk, you're already gone. That's it. Don't mess with the basilisk. But the viper, which is I think the standard translation for it, is portrayed as emerging from the root of the serpent, ufirio saraf me'ofeith, and his fruit is even better, a flying poisonous serpent. Right? Those are really dangerous. Maybe that's a basilisk.
They're missiles.
Yes, that's the alternative. Missiles. Yes.
Isn't Shimshon compared to Nachash in the Brachos?
Shimshon is indeed compared to an Nachash. So you think it's a descendant from Shimshon? That's interesting. I hadn't seen anybody suggest it, but it's an interesting idea.
Either Hizkiyahu is bent or a descendant of the Assyrian king who ruled you above.
Right, so the assumption is that it is not about Assyria. I understand that they may mention that as a possibility, but as Abarbanel notes, the text fits very simply and straightforwardly as being exactly about Hizkiyahu. Yeah. And it's saying, you thought that the venom and the teeth, the fangs of these Jewish kings are gone, But Chizkiyahu is coming. And when Chizkiyahu comes, you're going to be in trouble. It's not about the Assyrian invasion. Now, the image of a flying serpent is really fascinating. What is this flying serpent thing? So, first of all, worth noting, we don't know about a descendant of Chizkiyahu who's going to rule over them. So that may be why Rashi says it doesn't mean his fruit, it means his deeds. His, like Toledot often is, it's his product, what he does, are going to be this flying serpent. But it's interesting because Yeshaya in chapter 30 also has a flying serpent, also in reference to a vision of punishment coming to the south. So this must have been a thing, the idea of the flying serpent. Malbim says, if you take a look at source number 2, Upri hatsefa hazeh yeyes saraf. The fruit of this viper will be a venomous snake, ve'erez me'ofeif hamazik l'me'rachuk. Flying venom, which will cause harm from afar, missiles indeed. They show Chizkiyahu, that's Chizkiyahu, Upri ma'asa v'atovim she'ezikul lach, and the fruit of his good deeds, which are going to harm you. I wonder if the reason for the serpent image, although I like what Janine says about Dun, who inhabits that area, being compared to an Achash, but I would actually roll that into the following. Where do the Plishtim live? We already talked about where they live. Aza, the Western Negev. They live in the Western Negev, which is home to poisonous snakes. I did my homework. The Levant Viper and others. I wonder if that isn't exactly what this is. In other words, you're mentioning what is for them the indigenous enemy. That's what they will be afraid of, are snakes. Right? If you tell me in Toronto that you're going to bring poisonous snakes, I might be afraid because I think I don't know how to deal with that. I never deal with them. But if you talk to people who actually live among them and you say, you're going to be attacked by poisonous snakes, they know what that means. So I wonder if he isn't using their language, and I wonder if that isn't why Dun is compared to the Nachash, because that is his land.
Yeah.
That's exactly, I think it makes a lot of sense.
It's reminding me, many years ago when I lived in Israel, I worked for the Department of Entomology and Poisonous Whatevers, okay, in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And they were great experts.
There could be a lot of whatevers there.
We used to go on field trips to go and collect, you know, and they became experts because they were trying to make anti-serum for people who were being bitten. It was down in the Negev. I still have some pictures. Black widow spiders and poisonous vipers.
Cool.
And so I'm remembering, I don't know how I lasted there. I used to enjoy the pickled creatures all the time.
Okay. I know lots of pickled creatures. Okay, okay. So, this is the prediction, is that the Plishtim will be vulnerable to this attack, and it continues in Pasuk Lamed in sentence 30, V'ra'u b'chorei dalim v'evyonim l'vetach yirbatsu. So, at that point, the firstborn of the indigent, the paupers, they're going to be safe. The people you harmed and attacked in the days of Achaz, they're now going to graze. Behemati barav sharsheich, and your root, as opposed to the root of Chizkiyahu, your root is going to be killed in hunger. Usheiriteich yaharog, he's going to kill those who remain. Heilili shar zaki ir namog pleshet, the wailing should come from the gates, from the city, they melt. Namog pleshet kuleich, kimitzafon ashan bak. His smoke is coming from the north. This is not Babylon, mitzafon tipatachara. This is us. We are north to the Plishtim. Because even though it's true they're on the coast, most of Judea, and certainly Israel, is north to the Plishtim. So it's talking about Chizkiyahu attacking and saying that they are going to they're going to be attacked. And here it's very interesting to note it builds in intensity in this sentence 31. First it's the gate, then it is the ear, the city, and then it is Peleshet Kuleich, all of Peleshet. He's building in intensity. Yeshaya likes to do things like that. And then the last sentence is a little bit odd. Last sentence requires some thought. That sentence is very strange. That first half. Why is that hard to translate? What's the grammatical problem? without looking at English translations, just what's the grammatical problem with the first half of the sentence? Well, Ya'aneh is singular, Malache is plural, right? So it sounds like you have to read it as, what will he answer to the emissaries of the nation? But I don't know who he is. I don't even know what nation it is that's sending emissaries. What are you talking about? So even Ezra and Radak offer a suggestion, which I brought you in number 3 on your sheet. It means each individual agent from each individual nation, meaning all the nations are going to send their scouts to see what's going on. What is each individual scout going to say? They're going to say the rest of the sentence, that God has established Zion, v'lo yuchal melech Ashur la, and therefore Assyria cannot defeat her. When we are resurgent under Chizkiyahu, we will not be vulnerable to the Assyrians. That's Ibn Ezra and Radak. Abarbanel notes, though, when we get to Sanherib and his invasion, where he attacks Jerusalem, we are going to find that Sanherib sends emissaries. He sends scouts. So Abarbanel suggests these are specifically the Assyrian scouts that we're talking about. And then he notes an additional idea, which you're familiar with. We've talked about it on other occasions. The idea mystically that each nation has a malach, not meaning an agent, but meaning an angel. Malachei goy are the angels of each nation. And that what's happening is the angel of the plishtim is going to argue for God on their behalf. And God's response is going to be, I have established Zion, forget about it. That's going to be God's response to the malach of Pleshet. So you have all these different approaches. It could be that it's saying that the nations are going to send scouts, and word is going to spread via those scouts that Zion is back, and therefore even the Assyrians can't invade. Or it's the scouts of the Assyrians who are going to find out that Zion is back, or it's the angel of Pleshet, of the Plishtim, who's going to argue before God on behalf of the Plishtim and not succeed. Malbim has yet another take, but I'm not bringing it, it's just too much. He goes off in another direction with it. But what we get here, fundamentally, and what I want to make sure that we remember, is this very small vision here compared to what we saw for Babel, and Babel in general gets the most real estate, so to speak, of all of these visions against our foes. The largest amount of text is devoted to Babylon, which makes sense, knowing their relationship with us and what they would do. But here it's just a tiny message. And it's historically rooted. It's, you thought that you were triumphant after Uzziyahu. Uzziyahu gave it to you. You had a hard time under Uzziyahu. You thought under Ahaz, aha, we're back, we're going to beat Judea. God's message to the Jews of Judea is to say, Chizkiyahu is coming, and the Plishtim will not reign over you any longer. That's the statement, with an added dose, potentially, of hope for what's going to happen with the Assyrians. Clear?
Did the Plishtim ever conquer
Israel? I don't believe so. I mean, they did in the early days. And you go back to their early days. And when you say Israel, do you mean Israel, Northern Kingdom, or do you mean just the Jews? The Jews. So if you go back to the period of Shmuel, if you go back to the period of Shaul, they were more powerful than we were. I don't think they covered all the real estate, because remember, their stronghold was still off to the west. But they were in control. We were paying them tribute. We were afraid of them. Right? If you keep in mind the story in Shimshon's day, where the people of Yehuda turned Shimshon over to the Plishtim, granted with his cooperation. But the point is, they were afraid of the Plishtim and of reprisal from the Plishtim in the event that they didn't cooperate. Mush.
First of all, the messengers, it seems to me that it would have, the thing that makes most sense is that in an area where a lot of countries are in a process of ascendancy and the opposite,
yep,
they're going to have as many and as good spies,
yes,
in this area and probably within the army itself. so that they could report exactly what's going on.
Right.
What bothered me more is I'm surprised that, particularly, what else we know about Yeshayahu, that given how we know how this play ends, Yeshayahu doesn't take some stand advocating peace, a peaceful resolution rather than fighting, which we know is going to be not kind of well. It is all about fighting.
Right.
Or conflict.
I mean, keep in mind, Yeshaya, like every Navi, has messages that are appropriate for each recipient and for each situation. The people he's speaking to here, we've said, are, and certainly in this case, because it's actually dated, the people who are living under the Philistines, afraid of multiple invasions, right? Whether it's the Assyrians or it's the Northern Kingdom partnering with the Plishtim. And what they need is not an ethical message of you should govern yourselves with justice, right? That's not what they need. What they need is a pep talk. They need somebody to say, don't be afraid, God is on your side, they're not going to beat you.
I agree with you. It seems that God's getting the wrong message.
Is it the wrong message? I think it's a good message. I understand the appeal of the Kumbaya part of Yeshayahu. I get it. But it's not the right message for all times and for all people. I think that's a fundamental point. Okay, there's more to be said and there's more to be asked.
If it's a prophecy, it's not advice. First of all, he's a messenger from God.
I mean,
and God is saying, this is what's going to happen. And that's what happened.
Right, prophecies are advice.
But in this case, it sounds like he's prophesying something that's going to happen, which is...
Right.
You know, in other words, this is not telling people how to behave. I think it's telling them, don't worry.
Right, but don't worry, and therefore, don't try to make alliances, and don't put your faith in them. There are practical applications to what he's saying.
Like, how can he decide to counsel peacemaking if... the messages.
Because his message is also one of peacemaking, just not right now, not in this situation, right? You find the prediction of there will be a time when you will be led by a descendant of Yishai, and he is going to have the nations come to him to learn the Torah of God and so on and so forth. But that's not what this period is about, and it's not what the Plishtim are about. This is a message of don't be afraid of the Plishtim. It's a different message and it's different purpose. But I do think that it absolutely has practical instruction that goes with it. In the same way that Yirmiyahu will be told to buy a land, right, and store the deed. It's a statement that you are going to be coming back. It's not that Yirmiyahu is getting a practical instruction and for everybody else it's just a prediction. It's a statement to all of them. You should know there will be a Geulah, there will be a redemption. Don't give up hope.
But was that? The final words are very telling. I'm speaking in English. Hashem has established Zion.
Yeah.
In it, the poor of his people will take shelter. That's a very defensive. Now, it's a strong defense, but it's not an offense.
I don't think so. I think it's an ethical statement that this is the God who protects those who are vulnerable.
Right. I hear you. I hear what you're saying, but keep in mind two things. First of all, it sounds like the entire nation is in that category. Go back to sentence 30. They're all in it. It's not aniyim among amo. It's aniyim who are amo. That's number one. But number two, go back to the flying venom. Right? This is not a this is not a defensive maneuver. Bria, you were going to say?
Yeah, this is not the same type of because Bacal is very much in the future when he's talking about Bacal.
Right, this is immediate.
This is much more immediate.
Yes.
This is something that they know is going to be, I don't know, tomorrow, but soon.
Next king.
So in other words, they are aware of the future right now.
Oh, yeah.
Happening now.
Absolutely. Stronger. This is the year of Ahaz's death. That means Hezekiah is now ascending the throne. Correct.
So he's mixing in something that's going to happen.
Yes. Correct. Bavel went first. I think we asked the question of why Bavel is first, and the chronology of it makes it kind of funny that Bavel is first, because their event isn't until later. But the answer is pride of place.
Okay.
You know, it's they're the destroyers of the first temple. God's going to put first, or the Antik Nes, the Agadola, or Chizkiah's group, whoever it is that you're going to credit with deciding what goes where within this book. The Gemara says it's Chizkiah and his associates. But they're the ones who sit down and say, yeah, let's put Babel first. But from a chronological perspective, we can give a variety of answers, I think. But you're going to see Moab. We're not going to get it now. It'll be after Pesach when we get to the end of Moab. We're going to find out that the prediction of Moab's destruction is coming in 3 years. He says that explicitly. So, yes, these are shorter term that we're getting to. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Now, what the timing is for Moab is interesting, but let's just make sure. Okay, we got the Plishtim down? We're done with the Plishtim? Okay, let's move on to Moab.